Okay, we're recording.
Okay, good. Well, as mentioned last time, we're doing the same sort of format in which I'm going to talk for a few minutes on a particular book and then leave you to read it and then discuss various things afterwards. And I shall give you some clues and some questions and things to guide your reading. As this is a longer book, it may well be that you don't get through it all, which is fine. It's got 13 chapters, and at the normal speed of reading in about half an hour, you might only get through the first 10. But you may be very familiar with chapter 11 anyway, and you can always read the rest of it later. So we're going to be looking at the letter to the Hebrews. And the first few things to say about it are the usual sort of who, what, where, why, when, and so on. So this letter to the Hebrews, we've absolutely no idea now who wrote it. It was originally thought maybe by Paul, but it's quite clear now that it isn't. So there's been a few guesses, but no one's got any real idea. One thought is it could be by Barnabas, and it's got lots of encouragement in it. And other suggestions include Stephen, but he wasn't like to be alive at the time it was written. And Priscilla, and it was left nameless because he was a woman and it wouldn't be thought to be right to put a woman's name on it. But it's not something that we can ever discover now, so the clue has to remain unknown. Far more important, though, would be why it was written. And perhaps to get a clue on that, we need to know where. So, if we turn to the last chapter, chapter 13, chapter 13, there's a reference to Italy. This is verse 24. Chapter 13, verse 24, that it was written from Italy. And so the most likely guess from there is that it was written to Christians in Rome, probably a few years after Paul wrote to them. Certainly the letter was quoted in the city of Rome, and certain things in the letter do actually point to what was happening in Rome around the time from, say, around 65 AD. As to the when, there's another clue in chapter 13 and verse 7. Another intriguing that it says, "Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you, and consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate them." That seems to suggest that their initial leaders are no longer there, that they've died. They spoke. They taught them rather than they are teaching them now. So it could be that some time has passed and the initial leaders are no longer there with them. But they're to remember them and imitate them. So we've got a church that hasn't been just established, it's been around some time. And again, as far as the time is concerned, the things in the letter that suggest that the temple is still functioning. In Jerusalem, that is, of course. Not that it used to be like this, but that it still is. So, in making the comparisons with the temple, you would have the temple still around, and therefore that would put it before AD 70, but after Paul had written to them around AD 55. So, it's somewhere in that particular time period. And what's interesting about that particular time period is that if it is indeed in Rome, then the church in Rome has undergone certain changes because it began as a totally Jewish church, not founded by anybody as such, but by those who had come to the Lord, probably at Pentecost. And then the Gentiles came in and it became a church of Jew and Gentile together. But then the Jews were banished from Rome. Emperor Claudius banished 10,000 Jews from Rome, most notable Aquila and Priscilla, that we eventually read about. go to Corinth and meet Paul there. So the church changes its nature again into being more a Gentile church. But after Claudius died, the Jews were welcomed back. So Jewish believers came back into the church at Rome, and now it is mixed again. And that created some of the tensions that you may read about in that election as well. So by this time, we've probably got Nero now as the emperor. Nero eventually a very bad name for what he did. But to start with, he was quite decent. He only later gradually became corrupt and turned against Christians as a growing wave of hostility towards them. So it's the beginning of something here, probably a time of persecution, but not yet the most severe persecution. If you look at chapter 10 and verses 32 to 34, there's a mention of some of the problems they were having. So have a read of chapter 10 and verses 32 to 34, and you realize that this had become a church that was suffering for having standing their ground. But the sort of suffering was still relatively light compared to what was still to come. Talks about being publicly exposed to insult, persecution, those in prison, property being confiscated. But it adds a little later on in chapter 12 and verse 4 that in your struggle you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. In other words, Christians were not yet being put to death like they were going to be eventually later in the reign of Nero. So there was some suffering, but yet no martyrs. Nero didn't begin killing Christians until later in his reign. Now, the question is this really a letter? The fact that it doesn't start with a greeting, so we don't know who wrote it, suggests it perhaps isn't quite the same as the sort of letter that we're used to. If we look at chapter 13 and verse 22, an intriguing little statement there, chapter 13 and verse 22. It is called a letter. But the author says, I have written you only a short letter. So if this is an example of his short letters, I've got no idea what his long ones would be like. But he does at least call it a letter. But actually, he also says in that verse, my word of exhortation. And it's probably better to think of it as a word of exhortation rather than a letter in the way that the other letters are letters, so to speak. So an exhortation involves two things usually. There's a negative and a positive. There's a sort of don't do that. And then there is, please do this. So you'll find throughout the letter that the writer uses both forms. He's urging people to a course of action, but he's also admonishing people urgently not to do something as well. And I'll say a little more about that later. In fact, to mention it now, the two main things to look out for is when he's actually telling the believers here, firstly, don't go back, but secondly, do go on. So those are the two aspects of this exhortation. Don't go back, but go on. In fact, the book could be summed up as a big, come on, keep going, let's go forwards, rather than backwards. 13 times the writer says, let us. So there's one task you can do in those, in half an hour or so when you're reading it. See how many times, and underline perhaps, or think about when the writer says, let us. He's encouraging us to continue in the journey. And he says, I've got confidence you will do it. So it's not just a letter, it's more a treatise, really. It's more a matter of encouraging people to go on in a certain way. And that's why the most famous chapter, chapter 11, is packed full of people of faith that we can learn from. If anything, the first 10 chapters are the negative bit, and then he starts to get more positive towards the end. Now, something else to think about all the time as you are reading through it is, because it's the letter to the Hebrews, there's an awful lot that links back into the Old Testament. In fact, without a knowledge of the Old Testament, a lot of what he's going to write about doesn't make a lot of sense. But every time you come across what things that he says from the Old Testament, think, is he actually displaying a contrast here or a continuity? Are there things that we leave behind, or are there things that we have to continue in when it comes to the Old Testament? And getting that correct, understanding which things are contrast and which are continuity, is a very important part of understanding how the scriptures work together. So look out for the contrast where it says there's a discontinuity. Also look out for things that are going on as a continuity. And another word to keep an eye open for, and again underline and think every time you come across it, probably the key word to the whole book is better. He uses the word better repeatedly. So see what he actually says, this is better or that is better.
The epistle of Paul the Apostle.
So in another thing to look out for is when he uses types. Okay, now types are where he's going to refer back to things again in the Old Testament and say that was the shadow, this now is the substance. We'll see how many different types you can find where he's drawing some teaching from something that once was the case, but now we've moved on to something more. Another feature to look out for is where he issues a lot of warnings. I'm going to give you the verses here so that you can make sure that you cover them all if you wish. So there are four main places where he issues very strong warnings and appeals. And the first one is in chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. Obviously, based upon his argument of chapter 1. The next one is in chapter 3, verses 12 to 14. Chapter 3, verses 12 to 14. And then chapter 6, verses 4 to 12. And then later on in chapter 10, with verses 26 to 31 and verses 35 to 39. So that's chapter 10, verses 26 to 31 and 35 to 39. These are quite severe passages, and people struggle with these sometimes, but they're there for a good purpose. So see if you can work out what that purpose is and understand how the warnings seem to get stronger as you go through the letter. Another feature and a question to sort of go with all this is, what do we actually learn about Jesus from reading this book? Some people have described Hebrews as the fifth gospel, as though after the four gospels, this is the next and most important book about Jesus. I personally think it's more like the sixth gospel, because the book of Acts, I would want to call the fifth gospel, because in the book of Acts, we learn what Jesus continued to do on earth by his spirit through the apostles. But what we're going to learn about Jesus in this book is what Jesus is still doing now in heaven. And actually, there's a lot about Jesus in this book that really we can't do without. Because he's alive, then we need to know what he's continuing to do. So bear that in mind as a particular question. What do we learn about Jesus as we go through this? Another question and thing to look out for is to see what is more practical than doctrinal. There are some doctrines in this, but whereas Paul writes a letter usually with the first half being full of doctrine and then the second half full of practical things, he sort of mixes them in a little bit more. And it's probably a good example of the more practical side of things. So always ask yourself, what is it that he wants us to do? What are the practical aspects of what he's saying? And so on. And to help you on that, look for any practical advice that concerns relationships. Look for the key words, each other. You get them in other letters and books as well. But whenever he says something to do with each other, then that's a practical thing worth thinking about. And another practical thing is, what does it teach us regarding preparation for any persecution that we might come across, either now or in the future? So if it was written as a time when persecution was beginning, though it wasn't yet totally severe, then there might be something there for us to learn in terms of what persecution might be like for us and what we should do to prepare for it. And all the time, keep looking for the exhortation not to go back. Whatever the temptations, whatever the problems, whatever the difficulties, going back is not an option, because what we have now is better than anything we had before, and particularly what they had before. And look for Jesus, look for him as our model. He's called the pioneer, the author, the perfecter of our faith. There are certain things about him that are quite unique to this letter, so make sure you find out what he's saying about Jesus there. Now, I think that's enough sort of background and things to look out for, questions to ask, and so on, to get you reading, if not, as I say, if not all of it, at least as much as you want to, so you can go in your own pace and you can skim through bits you're familiar with, but you might find you're drawn to other passages that you've not thought of before. So if God is telling you to slow down and really focus on something, that's fine. It's better than rushing to the end. You can always read the whole thing through another time. So just before I sign off for half an hour, is there anything I've said that you want to clarify or ask a bit more about or make a further comment on? Or do you think you're ready to go? Any questions?
You may need to switch on your microphone if you've got a question. Some of you switched off.
I'm very sorry, but I came in late and I picked up the bit where we've got to look for the betters. Was there much before that?
Well, there was.
Okay, don't worry then.
No, I'm sorry, but all I was saying at that point was that it's a key word to look out for. And every time you see the word better, it will help you to understand the nature of his argument.
I think we said Hebrews 10.
Anything else then before I leave you to do some reading and then we come back and discuss it in about half an hour, see what other questions you come up with or things you want to share based upon what you read in it.
Okay, I shall mute everybody, and if you'd like to switch, then you can just get on with it without us disturbing each other in half an hour. We'll switch back on it.
Yeah, or maybe you've got about 35 minutes if you want to go till 8 o'clock, because I've sort of finished a bit early, really, which was no bad thing. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Paul. I shall switch off the recording.
Who mistreated the servants, and then the owner said, I'll send my son. And of course, they mistreated him as well, but Jesus is far superior to anyone that's gone before. Did you find any of these betters? What sort of things are now better?
The what? Let us.
The better. Yeah, sorry, there is the let us as well. Yeah, I'll come back to it now. Just because we're talking about Jesus being superior and so on. Where's the word better used? How about better blood? Did you find that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All the other blood that's been shed, the blood of Jesus is the better.
One new man seems to use other words than better.
Such as?
Yeah.
Superior, yes. It does when it talks about Jesus' superiority over Moses, Joshua, the angels, and so on.
Yeah.
It talks about Jesus being a better sacrifice.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And producing a better covenant.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And therefore, we've now got a better hope.
Yes, we've got better promises.
Better promises, yeah. That's a few of the ones. And I even found one phrase that said, just better things. I think it's what the writer was saying, but I believe that, believe in you, confident in you that you will do better things or something. There may be more, so, you know, as you read through it another time, be aware of this particular word or phrase. What about the let us then, or the encouragements, or the each other things? What's the positive side of things that we're to do in order to go on?
Persevere, endure.
Yes. Persevere, yeah.
Endure.
Yeah.
With strenuous earnestness.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. We would have strong encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
Let us lay aside every weight.
Yeah.
Yes. I think we all know about these weights. We get them all the time, don't we? But let us throw off everything that hinders. He loves these little pictures. There's some nautical pictures, doesn't he? I think he talks about anchor and lowering your sails or drifting away or coming into a safe harbour. So he was someone who either knew about sailing or did a bit of seafaring stuff. But here he's doing an analogy with athletics, I think, isn't it? About running the race.
Yeah.
It's chapter 12. Let us throw up everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us, we've got three letters there. Let us. Sound like I've got a bunch of lettuces, but you know what I mean. Chapter 12, there's letters in every verse, I think, there. Verse 1, verse 1, verse 2. And I said we ought to learn things about Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. That's a wonderful phrase, because it means we need him from the beginning and all the way through. So when we're struggling, he's the one that can perfect us. What's the other key things we might learn about Jesus? Anything else?
The doctrine of Jesus establishes his role as a sort of mediator between God and humanity.
As a mediator, yeah. There's quite a bit about his humanity in there, about him having to go through suffering and learn obedience and so on.
Yeah.
And make reverent submission. So you get a very high view of him as God's son, but equally about his humanity.
Yeah.
And that's important because of this role that the writer really sets up very strongly. He is our high priest. And this is something that you don't get, obviously, from the Gospels. In the Gospels, Jesus does not have a priestly role at all, really. He's a prophet, he's Messiah, he's teacher, and so on. But it's only in the light of his sacrifice, after his death and resurrection, does any idea start to emerge that Jesus is both our high priest and who makes the sacrifice of himself. But again, to show his superiority in this, he links Jesus back to Melchizedek, not to Aaron, not to Levi, but to Melchizedek, this extraordinary figure who gets about four verses in the Old Testament. That's all, just four verses in the Old Testament, and yet about three or four pages here. Because the writer, being Jewish and writing to Jews, knows how to do this strange thing we've talked about before, but I think called Midrash. He knows how to draw things out of small parts of the Old Testament and bring them to a new level. And you could say he does that a lot throughout the whole letter on all these different things. So it's very encouraging to realise that Jesus isn't just sort of sitting back now on the right hand of the Father on high and thinking, well, that's it. He is still very much interceding for us, being our great high priest, and so on.
The writer reminds us that that no matter how much we suffer, whether it's apostasy or anything else, in a way, suffering, Jesus has already done it all.
Yes.
That's the encouragement to me anyway.
Indeed. Yeah, he knows all about it. He's been through it. So do you think there's a strong pastoral element to this letter?
Yeah.
I think the guy has got a heart not just to teach things, but to get alongside people. He seems to have a great concern that these warnings are there more to sort of stop things happening, because he loves these people and he's confident that they'll go on.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a pastor or a leader like this, then he doesn't shirk the difficult bits like don't do this. He doesn't shirk the warning side of it. We need more leaders that are prepared to take seriously the things that we can do and go wrong and so on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's all just to sort of, oh, isn't it all nice and everything's going to be fine and so on. Did you learn anything about...
I was just going to say, can you hear me okay? Because my sound's a bit broken up.
It sounds like you've got something in your throat, but we can make out the word.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I was just going to say that he's very encouraging in that he reminds them of all the things that they did at the very beginning when they first were enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
So he said you must continue to remember the former days and therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward.
Yes.
Really good to say, remember what it was like. Don't give up. Be encouraged. Be patient. You know, you were fervent in your faith. You did these great things. And that's really encouraging to remind them.
Yes. He uses the past to point people forwards into the future. And sometimes we do need to look back and remember what it was like and build a, that we're building on something, that we're going on a journey and we're moving on. So, yes, we ought to remember what it was like, even if it's a long, long time ago. I think in this letter, I'd probably learn as much about salvation as I do in any of the other letters. I know we get the gospel message preached in the other letters and so on, but I find a lot here that helps me to get into the depth and the reality of what it is to be saved and how to go on in that salvation and how I'm meant to work it out and how I'm meant to see it as a process that I've entered into and I've got to persevere in. I suppose even if you didn't get to chapter 11, you're familiar with this great list of faithful people. And if there's one thing that sums it all up, is it's something like, by faith, somebody did something. Not that they believed something, but they did something. This is faith in action, isn't it?
How do you know? I like the word the one new man uses, because they use trusting.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I thought, yeah, that makes a change, actually. It makes a nice change. So well, you see the word translated trusting.
Yes. I know we've said this before, and Steve has as well, that you've got to see faith as a verb, not as a noun. We don't really have a verb to faith, but everywhere you read it in the scriptures, it's good to translate it as a verb, something that is an ongoing thing that you do. There's a continuity of faith as well. So, yeah. And of course, there's the encouragement that all these people were still living by faith when they died. That is absolutely crucial. Even if they didn't receive everything that they'd been promised, even if they only welcomed them from a distance, they went on longing for, oh, there's another better here, I found a better country. In chapter 11, obviously, there's a better country, well, a better place to go to, if you like, a better life to look forward to. Even if they didn't receive everything that they felt they were promised, they were still living by faith when they died. Another better is at the end of chapter 11, verse 40. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. So there's a lot of this doing things together, being together, meeting together, loving each other, encouraging each other, and so on, because on our own, we are likely to drift away, or fall away even, more seriously. Did you learn anything particular about persecution then, or?
Chapter 12.
How you prepare for it now, how you get ready for it?
Oh.
think the continuous reminder of the of Hebrews is glory of Christ should help us to stay away from falling away.
Yeah.
And the knowledge, of course, that Jesus was probably, well, it was, without doubt, God's final and greatest revelation to humanity.
Yes, indeed.
I think it also says that, you know, there are rewards for being faithful. If you stand your ground and you stand on the word of God, then,
yes,
and then, you know, we are rewarded for it. I think that's the encouragement for it.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. So that after you do the will of God, you would take the promise, and that means to carry off. And we need to really take hold of the promise with it, it says in One New Man.
Is if these Jewish believers did decide that it's a bit tough being a Christian, I can still be a Christian within Judaism, what they need to realise that in order to go back into Judaism, they would have to deny who Jesus was. The only way you'd be allowed back into Judaism. So you might have all the other bits and pieces, all the trappings and so on, but you would have to deny who Jesus is. And that means that the whole centre of it has come away and everything else then falls apart. So as it is, you can't. As you just said, if Christ is at the centre, then you hold together. But if you lose that, then everything, nothing else works anymore. You can't go back into the previous sacrifices and promises and so on. They were not bad. They were what was required at the time, but we've now got the better. He uses the idea of shadows, doesn't he, and a shadow and substance. A shadow is fine because it gives you the right shape, but of course it doesn't have the substance, but at least it's got the right shape. But it doesn't have the substance of things. Another thing he exhorts us to, again, which will help us in times of difficulty, as well as faith, he talks about holiness. Or, to put it in more practical terms, almost making sure you've got your various affairs in order, your marriage, your finances, things like that. Keep your lives free from the love of money. Be content with what you have. And keep the marriage bed pure. So on. So the best way to be ready for something that will, like the persecution that might come, is just to make sure you are as holy as God wants in these things. And I'm going to find it again, but I'll summarise. Sorry, someone else want to say something? Okay. You can say some more afterwards, but just to get this in now, five good reasons for studying Hebrews or for keep reading it and so on. One is it helps you to handle the whole Bible because it shows how the Old Testament fits into the New and so on. It gives you the whole picture with the continuity and the contrast. So it's a vital link, I think, within the whole biblical story. It builds real faith, the go-on believing type faith, the verb type faith, the one that we'll need when things get tough. It reminds us of the dangers of, well, not just falling away, but remember how it's put, sort of just simply neglecting. That's bad enough.
Yeah.
It makes that clear early on, I think, that How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? I found that a very sort of powerful thing. And just drifting. Drifting means you're just a bit careless. You go a little bit away, and then before you know it, you're a bit further away and a bit further away. It isn't necessarily that you've suddenly fallen completely away. It's just that you slip bit by bit. So it reminds us of the dangers of that. It gives us, I think, a deeper appreciation of Jesus. You see him as our pioneer, the author, perfecter, the way he was tempted, that he did it all for us, that we don't need any other priest. As you said, he's the final revelation. It is a Christ-centered letter, despite all the other stuff around it. He is prominent throughout. And I think that this letter also should keep us in a sort of reverent frame of mind, with an awe of God, and serious about coming into his presence, and not get sort of all casual and over familiar with things. But above all, he writes with a confidence that when they've read this letter, he is sure that they will want to go on and to go on going on, and will avoid some of the temptations to go back, because he spelled it all out very clearly.
You know, I read this book, Paul, and I just think to myself, it must have been very difficult for people who had been brought up in the Jewish faith to actually leave that behind them and then move on to Christianity. This book and this writer sort of encourages that, come on, it's going to be okay. This is a new way, but we're not actually leaving the God that we knew. Do you understand what I mean? It must have been quite... Yeah. Quite thing for them to leave the comfort of their Judaism and move on to this new faith.
Yeah.
And there's somebody saying to you, "Well, it's better. You know, Christ is better than the Old Testament. The New Covenant is better than the Old, etc." But you know, it must have been quite a thing to move from one to the other. I don't know.
Well, it is a big thing, because, you know, but this is it, you know, this is what it's been all about. This is what it's been working up towards. And it's helpful to have that explained, so you don't think you're sort of leaping across from one thing to another. You're just making the next big step into what's been there prepared for you all along, that God has been planning and preparing. And now it's arrived.
But he does make the point very early on in the book that actually the same God is revealed in both, with both, through Christ and through the Old Testament. And I think it must have been quite hard to get people to break away. There would have been a pull back to the Old Testament.
Yes. Oh, quite possibly, yes, because being devout, and as there would have been these particular people and so on, it's always tempting to think, well, I had it right up to that point.
Why is it wrong now?
but once you've seen what Jesus has done, that should be...
In the Old Testament, they knew about God, but they didn't know him. It's the revelation through Jesus that you can actually know God. It's the fulfillment of everything that it was leading up to. Rather than jumping from one thing into something different.
Yes.
That the understanding of that gets clearer if you listen to or watch any of the One for Israel things on YouTube of Jewish people to know their Messiah and how it all suddenly comes to life.
Yes.
It's not a dump all the old stuff, because my father was Jewish and he became a believer, and he was in the days when Hitler was coming to power in Germany, And sadly, when he arrived in England and ended up at Theological College and see the vicar, at some point he was told that you're a Christian now, you've just got to leave behind all that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
totally wrong.
No.
Yeah.
I think we must commend whoever he was or is, the writer of Hebrews, because I think he comes forth with so many lessons, even you could argue tellings off, but he does it in a way that encourages you rather than react negative.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yes. As I said earlier, that's because I think he's got a pastoral heart. You don't sense any great wagging of fingers and tutting and shaking of heads and things. He's wanting to get behind you and, you know, stop you falling.
And push you forward at the same time, yeah.
Push you forward and then link arms with you and say, come on, come on, let's keep going.
Yeah.
And every now and again, this comes right to the fore. I mean, some of the bits and pieces are very much, you need the sort of Jewish background to get into the details of what he's saying. I love the bit, it's in chapter 5, you know, we've much to say about this, but it is hard to explain because you are slow to learn. That you ought to be teachers, but you know, you're needing someone to teach you this all again. You need milk, not solid food.
Sure.
So, and then he says, let us leave the elementary teachings about Christ and go on to maturity. What are these elementary teachings? The foundation of repentance from acts that lead to death, faith in God, instruction about baptism, the laying on of hands, the resurrection of the dead, and eternal judgment. So that's just the elementary stage. So hopefully we've got all that sorted out, because that's just milk. God permitting, we will go on from there. So that's the one time when he has a bit of a moan at them, or certainly some of them. So I suppose that means he knows them quite well. Either he's part of their congregation, or he's someone who visits regularly, because he is aware that he's had to spend a lot of time going through some basic stuff with him. Well, what he calls basic anyway.
Paul, I arrived a bit late. Did you say at the beginning this idea that this may have been written to the Essenes?
No, I haven't even heard of that idea.
Right. Someone said that because he talks quite a lot about temple worship, even explaining it quite basically,
they
gave rise to this idea that maybe these were Jewish people who didn't really know much about temple worship.
Oh, okay.
Therefore, perhaps it was a Jewish group that had set up somewhere outside of Jerusalem, like perhaps the Essenes or maybe another group.
Okay. Well, I was pointing out that it's often thought that these were Hebrew Christians in Rome.
Ah, right.
And I don't suppose there'd be many Essenes as such there. Pointed out the background at how the church there obviously started off very Jewish. Gentiles came in, the Jews were expelled, and then they came back again. But this would be written when the temple was still in operation.
Yes.
So I suppose what you're saying is he's filling in the details of their Jewish background that they weren't familiar with. The other thing is that they were familiar with it and he's building upon it and using it. So, yeah. But, no, I hadn't heard that idea.
I think following on from that thought, that there were a number of people who were living in Qumran, Essenes, who were considering leaving and going back to Jerusalem. So going back to their former life was a physical journey.
Okay.
So there was a sense of, you know, shall we give up this? This is perhaps too hard what we're trying to do here. And shall we go back into the rabbinic Judaism?
But the Essenes were just Jewish, weren't they? They weren't Christian.
Well, that was the question. Was, you know, maybe some of them, maybe it wasn't for the whole community. Maybe some of them were Messianic in some way.
Yes. Well, I've not heard of that. It sounds intriguing, but a little speculative on the basis of...
Oh, yeah, it's definitely speculative.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it would work just... I mean, I like to think, obviously, the guy wrote for a group of people he knew, and that's it. But then it got passed around and spread around because it's here in the Bible for us. So if God knew that some Essenes were in a similar position, he would have made sure that they got a copy of this, or someone turned up and read it to them, or... Mm. Gave the same teaching, so. But yes, I think that is interesting. That would have the same level of temptation for them, wouldn't it? To stop being sort of that kind of Jew and go back into more normative Judaism. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Any final comments or thoughts or questions?
That's very good.
There was one comment about the final thing that Paul wrote, or if it was Paul, the thing where he says, I've written a letter in a few words.
Yes.
Often at the end of some of his letters, the scribe writes most of it, and then he writes a little bit by hand on the scroll at the end.
Yes, okay.
So it may be that he was referring to that as the few words.
Ah, okay. Yes.
I think certainly it seems clear that that's the case at some of the end of the more clearly Pauline epistles.
Yeah. Indeed. So verses 22 to the end might be an extra sign-off by someone who...
Yes.
Who someone else has written up his word of exhortation.
In neat writing.
Yeah.
Someone who is a good scribe.
But I think the point I was making about that is that although the sort of the irony of it being short, it doesn't actually read like a letter, like the other letters do. It is more, I called it a treatise, but I don't know what else to call it.
It's an instruction manual for daily living, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is, yes. Or encouragement and so on. So, yeah. Okay. Well, now next week, you want to know what we're going to do next week. Even less can I tell you what we're going to do next week because I haven't decided.
Okay.
And the reason I haven't decided is that I've got one or two things that I will think about doing eventually. But I might do another session like this. But at some point, we're going to look through the earlier chapters of Exodus and other related things.
Oh gosh!
But we're going to take a journey towards Sinai and pick out some of the details of that. So that might be next week. In which case, we'll be back to the other format of. We just keep going for the 90 minutes together. I won't ask you to read chunks of Exodus, but we'll have it open in front of us. I may come back to this format for one or two other books, and a lot of decision on what we do will depend how I get things sorted out in time. So that's it for today then, I think.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay.
Apologies, I missed the beginning, the first few minutes of the second half.
Okay.
Suddenly remembered, whoops, better start recording. So sorry to all the listeners.
Oh, actually, so you've been recording some of this.
Oh, it's just the first couple of minutes of the second half, that's all that I missed.
Yeah, okay. I forgot to say start recording again anyway, but you have been recording it, yeah.
Your fault, okay. Then. Okay.